Right. It's good to be with you again. Just a verse, if we could, first, from a psalm. Psalm 121. I lift up my eyes to the hills, from where will my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. He who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and will be forevermore. Amen. Today, we're going to be looking at chapters 32 and 33 of the book of Genesis. I would ask you to have it open, that is Genesis 32 and 34, because we'll be following through in a degree of detail. Chapter 31 took us to the end of the stay of Jacob in Padan Aram, right? He had that rather interesting tussle with Laban, his uncle come father-in-law, as he was leaving secretly by night. And Laban got a little bit upset, as you know, and said, why didn't you give me the chance to say goodbye to my daughters and to my grandchildren and so on? We could have put on a feast, in fact, and have a celebratory, a farewell celebration as you go. But Jacob, I don't think, quite trusted that that would be the case. In fact, Rachel stole the household goods, and then there was that episode of Laban coming chasing household gods, not the household goods, the teraphim, coming chasing after them. And Jacob, in fact, saying, let the one who has taken them die. So sure was he that no one had taken them. Right. And we know that as we don't hear anything more about Rebecca after she said in that early episode when Jacob and she connived to steal the blessing and he was getting a bit nervous and she said, let the curse fall upon me, my son. And then we don't hear anything more of her, do we? That's the last we hear of her in the whole story. And now, of course, as he's leaving Padan Aram, Jacob is so confident that no one has stolen the household gods that he says, let that person die. And in fact, she does, in childbirth. And so the potency of the word, even when it is a curse, you might say, or a death wish, is in all evidence. So Jacob's on his return home. The last time we heard from Esau, it was those words, I'm going to kill that scoundrel. Next time I lay hands on him, he's dead meat, isn't he? And so you can imagine that there's a degree of nervousness. We've had no sense of any kind of a communication between home and the land of Padan Aram in the 20 years that have transpired, the 14 years of payment for the hands of Leah and Rachel in marriage, and then the 6 extra years for the speckled, striped and spotted livestock, all of which bred very, very rapidly and quickly to Jacob's advantage. So now he's on his way home, and how is he going to be met by Esau, whose last words were, next time I see you, you're dead meat. Right, so that's how chapter 32 begins. They come to a place close to home. Jacob says, this is God's camp. So he called that place Machanaim. Machanaim, which means camp, comes from a verb which sort of suggests to incline or to bow down. And this little section ends in verse 21, where we see the reference again to the word camp. I think they kind of provide inclusios, you might say, or brackets, bookends, call them what you will, around the passage. The two references, beginning and end, to the word camp, referring to God's camp. Angels are there. Angels always the representatives of God, the messengers of God. it seems to me that this is a good sign, a positive sign, because as much as Jacob might think that his life is terribly much in danger, the very fact that he is being welcomed to this place by holy angels should be a good sign and a positive sign for him. Now, I've given you at the very first little section, chapter 32, verses 1 to 21, on the sheet that I handed to you, something of what I understand to be the arrangement of these 21 verses. Notice 1 matching with 1 what I'll call prime. 1, they spend the night in the camp is the way the thing ends. The report of Esau's approach, first and foremost. He is approaching, so Jacob sends messengers to see whether Esau knows that he's coming, and is he there with arms outstretched waiting to welcome him home, embrace him to his heart and all the rest of it. And the messengers come back, and what's their message in verse 6? We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and 400 men with him. 400 men with him. 400 men elsewhere in the Old Testament always refers to a military detachment. It's a military detachment. He is coming armed to the teeth, and so also his 400 men. He hasn't forgotten a thing. So the report of his approach, and what does Jacob do? He divides his company into two, so that if Esau falls upon one, he's cutting his losses. All right, though he'll be so busy dispatching them, right, that at least have half of his goods and chattels and family members surviving. This is desperate stuff, folks. This is really desperate, a very, very intense encounter. So I said there, to minimise damage, you might say, to cut his losses at number 3. I would suggest to you that right at the heart and the centre of this section is a petition. A petition. And that is virtually verse about 11 or 12. Deliver me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I am afraid of him. Either side of that, immediately before and immediately after, you might say that there are some, you could almost call them pressure tactics. Jacob reminds God of his promise to bring him back home safely. You have blessed me thus far. Please continue with the blessings. But the most important part of the prayer is at the very heart and centre, and that is verse 11. Deliver me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I'm afraid of him. A petition for help. We get that repeatedly in the Psalms of Lament. In the Old Testament, where the person is surrounded by enemies, or he's beset by sickness, or he believes that God has not been kind to him, and so there is this prayer for deliverance, for healing, for help, whatever it might be. So it's a classic petition for deliverance. And it happens all the way through, say, the book of Judges, when the people are oppressed, the whole of the Israelite people are oppressed by the Midianites or the Ammonites or the Moabites or the Philistines, and they call on the Lord to deliver me from the hand of my enemy. So I think that here the petition which is referring to Esau is very, very much, Jacob is Israel, is he not? He is a representative of the whole people of God. And so Esau here too is portrayed as the enemy out of whose hostile grip he is praying that he be delivered. Ora et labora. Have you heard that saying? Ora et labora. Latin. Ora, pray. Yes, but pray and work, literally. Because ora is pray. Et labora. A very good school motto. And this is just what Jacob is doing. He's working feverishly to be protected from the hand of Esau, and he's also praying. And the prayer stands at the heart, and the feverish work, first and foremost, the division of his company into two, right, to cut his losses. And now next comes, from verse 13 and following, his next attempt. I've got that as number 3 prime. 3 prime. So 3 and 3 prime, both the work effort on the part of Jacob to get into, to ingratiate himself back into the good favours of Esau. What's this attempt? Livestock, property, you name it, and how much? And then he sends his servants with this material, one after the other, leaving a gap between them. This is to be a long, slow process of winning over the hostile brother. So first, he thought there was no hope, so he divided his camp into two. Now, well, maybe I can. And so he is sending lavish gifts. A very important note that we need to observe in terms of coming to understand this contact between Jacob and Esau is that what's going on is the ancient practice of bartering. Bartering, right? I offer you this in return for that. It's specified in verse 5, in verse 5 of chapter 32. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male and female slaves, and I've sent to tell my Lord, in order that I may find favour in his eyes. This is the bargain. This is the bargain. I, Jacob, am giving you this livestock in abundance in return for favour in your eyes. Right? So he's certainly playing his first hand, isn't he? He's playing his first hand very, very strongly by giving all of this livestock. He's almost given it all up right from the beginning, hasn't he? He's played all his cards. He's put himself, probably you might say, in a fairly vulnerable position. All right. That's chapter 32, verses 1 to 21. Interesting to look at the end of this section, verses 20 and following. And you shall say, that is the servants whom he sends with all of this livestock, moreover, say your servant Jacob is behind us, for he thought, I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me, and afterwards I shall see his face, perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself spent the night in the camp. What we can't see in the English there is that the word face in the Hebrew appears about 6 times. Just in those 2 verses, face. It's the first one is, I may appease him. That is, I might be able to cover his face, is the literal Hebrew, cover his face. Or to atone his face. The atoning sacrifice is a covering sacrifice. The present that goes ahead of me, in Hebrew, the word ahead of is constructed from the word for face. And afterwards I shall see his face at least once. At least once it's translated into English and we get the word face. Perhaps he will accept me, which is to lift his face towards me and beam his face on me. And so the present passed on ahead of him again, before him, which is before his face. So about 6, there's a lot of emphasis on the word face in this particular section. Anyway, we know what's going on. He's hoping and praying and pleading and working his little butt off and praying like crazy. And the prayer is at the center of the work of first dividing his entourage and then sending gift upon gift upon gift of livestock in order that he might meet Esau happily and in a friendly way. So what do you expect to happen next? We're expecting him, next thing, to meet Esau. But there's a little intervention, is there not, in the story? Whom does he meet? A man who wrestles with him, who turns out to be the Lord. Actually, the word a man could easily be translated as someone. Someone wrestled with him. And it's only as the fight goes on that Jacob realizes that that someone is indeed the Lord in this very strange guise, this very, very strange disguise. The Lord who attacks someone nocturnally. It's a bit like the troll under the bridge, isn't it? You know, the billy goat's gruff trying to get from one side to the other. We have a similar story in Exodus, interestingly, when Moses for the first time is going down to Pharaoh. Remember, he got married to Zipporah in the wilderness, but he had to go out because of his intervening in various douches, supporting a Hebrew against a Hebrew who was striking him, and then defending another Hebrew against an Egyptian slave master who was attacking him out in the wilderness. He comes back because the Lord says to him, "It is safe. All of your enemies, those in Egypt who sought to kill you, are now dead." That's chapter 4 of Exodus. Interesting story. Because you have a similar kind of a nocturnal encounter between a figure who turns out to be God and one of the biblical characters, in this case, Moses. Verse 24 of chapter 4 of Exodus. On the way, at a place where they spent the night, the Lord met him and tried to kill him. That's after the Lord has just told him, if you go back to verse 19, the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all those who were seeking your life are dead." How do we make sense of that? The Lord attacks him a bit like some sort of a desert, whirling dervish who comes in and tries to kill him. But Zipporah, interesting, it says tried. Zipporah took a flint, and it's all very obscure stuff, but it's another story. I think there's a lot of blood theology there, Passover theology, the importance of circumcision theology. All of that is built into that particular text. But also you've got marriage terminology, and where Israel has just been described in the preceding verses as son of God, so the father-son relationship between God and the people of God has been given there, then here I think it has to do with the husband-wife relationship. And so those two very, very special relationships between God and his people in terms of human analogies are spelt out in those few verses in Exodus chapter 4. But it takes us long further afield to get into that strange material. But it would seem that, as with the Jabbok incident, there are rather strange legendary accounts that lie behind the text that have been utilized for theological purposes. So to try to delve into what really happened, or how is this possible that God is able to be virtually even in a match, a wrestling match, with Jacob, and that he wants to finish the fight, that is, the Lord wants to finish the fight before the sun comes up. What in the world's that all about? That's the notion that there are certain evil forces or spiritual forces that don't survive very well in the bright light of day. And so they need to do their dirty business during the night. You know, that's sort of the kind of story that's behind it. And so we can easily get lost in that kind of detail and miss the point. What's going on here with this strange nocturnal wrestling match at the River Jabbok? Now, here's where I've sort of challenged a bit of the scholarship, and even my doctor father, I disagree with him entirely on this point. I was sent to study under him, so I went and disagreed with him at this particular point. And he took a very traditional kind of a line, unlike me. And he said, well, this has to do with a wrestling match. It has to do with, you know, the importance of prayer and the way in which we grapple with God throughout the night, and we're strengthened in our faith journey and all that kind of thing. It's a sort of a safe way of dealing with the story. I would like to suggest that Jacob at this particular point is really a man who has not done what he ought to have done as the patriarch in so many different ways. And certainly, I'm sure there's a growth experience that happens here, but I think that what's going on is that there is a radical contrast between what Jacob deserves at this particular point and what he in fact gets. what he in fact gets. Having been as disobedient and unfaithful as he has been, had told lies, cheated, won all sorts of competitions against back home and then against his father-in-law, his uncle, his brothers, and so forth, by a degree of underhandedness, it has to be conceded, that he deserves a number of things. One is to have his name, Jacob, rubbed in his face. Cheat, sneak, supplanter. Instead, his name is changed to Israel. We'll come back to that. Very, very interesting. He has his name changed by God, declares to him, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. It's interesting that of all the name changes that we get, Sarah and Abraham, go from Abram to Abraham, and Sarai to Sarah. In this case, Jacob to Israel is the one that doesn't seem to have sticking power. Because from here on in, Jacob is referred sometimes in the Bible, sometimes as Jacob and sometimes as Israel. Whereas with Abraham and Sarah, once their name is changed, the change stays. But not in this particular case. We'll have to have a look at the reason for the name Israel. You have striven with humans and with God, and you have prevailed. You have prevailed also over God. All right, so what he deserves is to have his name, Jacob, rubbed in his face. He also deserves probably to die. Instead, he lives. He deserves to have every bone in his body broken. But instead, his hip is put out of joint and so forth, and so he ends up with a limp. He deserves, really, I would suggest to you, on the basis of his conduct, the curse. But the blessing is reconfirmed in this particular incident, is it not? So I would suggest to you that what we have here is almost a good Lutheran law gospel kind of a thing, the radical contrast between that which Jacob deserves in terms of curse, in terms of death, in terms of having his name rubbed in his face, as it were, and confirmed, he instead receives the blessing and the name change. And only this little bit of a temporary crippling as opposed to having every bone in his body broken. That's the kind of suggestion that I would make here regarding this particular text. The importance somehow, too, it stresses, of Jacob being totally unaware that the rift in the relationship between him and his brother Esau is really symptomatic of a rift between himself and God. He thinks that it's all about, as he returns home, healing the rift with Esau. And I think the story, the way the story is told, this sudden, unexpected encounter with God, which comes upon him, who comes upon him totally by surprise, as a shock, indicates to us that the relationship with God is fundamental. If that relationship is poor, you know, it spills over into our relationship with one another and we can't live at peace with them. I think that's possibly part of the reason for slipping it in here before the expected encounter, immediate encounter, between Jacob and Esau. I've spelled out that in the middle part of page 1 of the handout to you. The mysterious encounter at the Jabbok, surprise encounter, expecting to meet Esau instead, God. Close connection between our relationship with God and our Christian brother or sister. How can you say you love God if you hate your brother or your sister, your fellow believer? I think that's in one of John's epistles, is it not? Deserving death for his disobedience, Jacob's life is saved. Deserving to have every bone in his body broke, has his hip put out of joint. Deserving the curse, he has the blessing confirmed. What about this name, Israel, which rather loosely translated, you have striven. It's a bit of a stretch using the Hebrew, but never mind. That's what is given as the interpretation. You have striven with God and you have, and with humans, and you have prevailed. I think we can see how he has prevailed over humans, has he not? Over his father, Isaac. He's been able to con him out of the blessing which was destined for Esau. Certainly got the better of Esau. And he's got the better of Laban. Laban sort of thought, well, I can see a a family resemblance with this man who's such a cheat and a sneak, so I'll see whether I can't beat him in his own game. And so he certainly, I think, Jacob wins hands down when it comes to that particular contest. His brothers-in-law, who become totally disgruntled as a result of the accumulation of wealth in the hands of Esau. So I think we can say that fairly clearly, that he has striven with humans and has prevailed. But what about striven with God? Is that literally simply just referring to this particular contest in the River Jabbok? And so forth, which seems to be a bit of an even match. And or is it more... is it broader than that? The initiative here is with God. God is the one who changes his name. He says, you. It isn't Jacob who is saying that I have striven with God and have prevailed. It's God who says that of him, isn't it? So it's an acknowledgement on God's part. I'm just wondering, this is a proposal, right? So it's sort of not, no hard and fast gospel account. I think it makes it a gospel point, but I don't think, because it's so difficult, isn't it? You have to admit that this is extremely difficult, and it's good to grapple with things that are difficult. And I don't think it's important that one view prevails over another, the way in which Jacob prevailed over God and his fellow humans. And so this is my proposal. And that is, if we compare Jacob with Abraham, for example, if we compare him with, because the previous cycle was basically about Abraham, not about Isaac. Isaac really, this is now Isaac's cycle, his sons. And Abraham was trying to do things his way, wasn't he? Eliezer will be my heir. You know, God's made the promise of offspring. Part of the blessing is offspring. And God said, not Eliezer. It was so... Abraham again tries to do things his way. And so when Sarah suggests Hagar, you know, she, the Egyptian handmaid, she can come into, you can come into her and so on and conceive. And so the child of the Egyptian handmaid will, no, not that way, not that way. When all human possibilities have come to an end, God insists, of course, that things be done his way, his way. And that's against all human possibility of it happening, that he and Sarah should have a child, right? And so, and that's made clear, and it's a wonderful thing. I think that what is going on here, it's a theory, is that it's as if God shrugs his shoulder, and he said, well, that episode with Rebecca and Jacob way back there where they deceived Isaac, that wasn't right. I could have provided, I'd promised that the younger would succeed over the older, right, and so on. It's important that I do things my way, but you and Rebecca have taken things into your own hands and have done it your way. And similarly in the land of Padan Aram, he has done it his way to accumulate all of these goods and possessions, whereas the Lord had every right to do it his way and not have him take things into his own hands. So that's just a theory, a proposal, that you have striven with God. And if he is Jacob, is Israel, right? Jacob is Israel. And Israel, come Jacob, is the recipient of the blessing. The blessing in terms of offspring, in terms of land, in terms of being a blessing to the nations, right? And God, it's as if shrugs his divine shoulders and says, I'm afraid that I've not chosen a nation that I'm particularly pleased with. It's always going its own way, doing its own thing, but nevertheless the blessing, the promise will continue, right? The grace endures in face of the misbehaviour. So it's just a proposal that I've come up with to suggest that, to contrast Abraham, who together with Sarah, is not allowed to do things her way, their way, as it were, and God chooses to do things by miraculous intervention, by divine intervention, and Jacob seems to take things very much into his own hands. Of course, it's consistent with the way God wants things to be, and God sort of says, I've got a rather troublesome child here in Jacob, come Israel, shrugs the divine shoulders, as it were, and lets it be. Well, it's a theory. The alternative is to see this as a very, and so I'll give you the other proposal, and that is that this is a wonderful story of faith and prayer and wrestling with God, and that's the way you will have mostly heard it preached in your sermons. But I'm afraid I've got the kind of mind that wants to try to make sense of some of the most difficult things in the text, and probably the other way, the traditional way that you've heard it, is a bit safer and easier. But I think my way sort of conforms with a very Lutheran approach, and so you also wonder whether you're imposing your Lutheran hermeneutic, you might say, on the text and allowing that. Because I often think that as people of a more reformed persuasion who like to see this incredible transformation in the person of Jacob and seeing him as a man who, by virtue of his experiences, goes from, you know, a rather selfish kind of a person to a man of great faith and prayer, it sort of serves our interest to read the patriarchs and the biblical characters in a more positive light. And so I've got a bit of a name for not being so inclined. Well, I don't think he changes much at all. No. Well, it's good to have you on my side, Bernice, on that one. Right. So, all sorts of interesting things in the Peniel event. The face of God, of course, I've seen God face to face and my life has been delivered, is the verb that is used there. Usually my life has been spared, but it's actually delivered, rescued. And then there's various things that are even more difficult to understand, but we can't go there. Chapter 33, the approach in verses 1 to 3.